Hail, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you that the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views. The views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And, you know, it is our contention that we're moving into very uncertain times. Within the last 3 or 4 days in Addis Ababa and Ethiopia, why massive demonstrations there? Because presidential election, which, of course, was supervised by the United States to make sure that the right candidate won, and the people didn't like that. There was massive demonstrations, about 25 people killed, hundreds injured in the demonstrations against the American imperialistic manipulation of the election for the presidency in Addis Ababa. And then, as you know, why Paris has been burning the last 5 or 6 nights, massive demonstrations by Muslim youth there, massive demonstrations in Argentina today, because the President Bush has gone down, and of course the people in South America feel that America is intervening in their elections and in the process, really in their lives, and they don't want America intervening in their lives. Today, of course, we have, at least according to the government figures, within the last 2 weeks, about 20 million illegal aliens in this country brought in with the full knowledge of our government, encouraged to come into this country, receiving welfare and aid and free medical care and subsidized education by our government that wants to create a condition that will lead to racial strife here. We live in uncertain times, and our plea to you is understand we live in certain uncertain times and begin making preparations for that. And to that effect, why we have with us Steve Sawyer, who comes from an organization known as Noah's Pantry, and he's been providing and helping people make preparations for difficult times for a number of years. I knew Steve 5 years ago when, of course, when the Y2K crisis looked like something was going to happen. Fortunately, it didn't happen. But Steve's been in that line of work for a long period of time. Steve Sawyer, thank you so very much for being with us this evening.
Thank you, Stan.
Well, let's now, of course, you've been, how long have you been
actually,
providing people?
Approximately 8 years we've been in business, trying to help people get prepared for uncertain times and kind of the storms of life, you know.
And, of course, Steve is a friend of Craig Roberts, who lives right back there, fairly close to Craig. And those of you who listen to our programs regularly know that Craig has certainly been one of our favorite guests. Well, anyway, are people beginning to wake up and realize they've got to start making preparations after what happened with Katrina and Rita and Wilma here recently, or is everybody going back to sleep again?
No, I mean, I have seen a little bit of interest that has perked up due to that, but I also have some dealers in the Florida area, but pretty much they're pretty blinded to things, and they're not very well prepared and continue to not be prepared even when they face big disasters like that. So it's kind of surprising, but
well, I think everybody really doesn't want to hear bad news. People don't like to hear they have cancer. People don't like to hear they have incurable heart disease. People don't like bad news, but, well, you really need to make preparations if you're going to die. Well, hopefully nobody's going to die from what lies ahead, but you certainly have to be prepared to look after yourself and your family. And the massive supplies of food they used to have here in the United States, you know, of the 3 years of supply for fruit for the American people, we don't have that 3 year supply of food for the American people anymore. And when we get back here in a few minutes with Steve, we'll begin talking about, well, maybe what we need, what you need to do to begin thinking about the uncertain times that lie ahead. Well, Steve, what sort of things should people be doing at this time?
Well, I think it's always good to have a 30-60-day supply of food on hand. I mean, I'd like to see people have more than that, obviously, but at least that if you had some kind of a terrorist attack or some kind of, you know, unrest going on where you're not forced to have to go to the local grocery store and compete for the little bit of food that's out there. You know, that's important. There's only about a 3 to 5 day just-in-time inventory out there, and if the trucks aren't rolling and constantly restocking these stores, there's very little food out there anymore.
And I really think that's really what's so amazing. It's just almost like, you know, right on time deliveries. And certainly that's great. You know, it cuts down on the inventory the stores have to keep. But the problem is that there is not a great deal of food in the pipeline. And the massive stores of wheat that we once had here in America, and of corn and other grain that would sustain the lives of the people in this country, have been shipped overseas, have been given away, have been sold. And today, why, we just no longer have those great stores. Have you talked to people about that? Are you are any people in your business sort of talking about what happened to these massive stores of food that we once kept here to sustain the lives of the American people?
No, I mean, not that I've spoken to. Most of them are just commercial dealers, and they're just, you know, they're just going about their business. They're not too educated on all this, and unfortunately, they don't pay a whole lot of attention themselves.
Yeah, so they're just worried about, you know, whether they're going to be able to move the product that they have out to people.
And usually in, you know, large truckloads is what they're, you know, on a smaller basis, they're not, you know, too concerned about things.
Well, now, what about certainly, there must have been an awful lot of food that was moved down under the Gulf Coast there. You're talking about literally 300,000 or 400,000 people who had their homes washed away. Not only in New Orleans, but, of course, what happened along the Gulf Coast was really just unbelievable. It just sort of looked like just nothing there. I know our good friend Colonel Tom McKinney had a home right along the Gulf Coast, and it was gone. Everything was gone.
I think a lot of the food reserves that were in place have been used for some of that relief effort, and I've heard a lot of the food banks are very, very depleted at this time going into the winter months where they typically need that for some of the homeless people, and it's very depleted right now due to those hurricane victims.
All right, fine. And but they can always, because, well, we're going to be back here in just a moment with our friend Steve. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Steve Sawyer from Noah's Pantry. And Steve, of course, comes out of Oklahoma, and his business is down there. And we're just talking about what's happened, certainly with the storms, Katrina and Rita and Wilma, why this took an awful lot of the food stores that we had. Now, of course, people have the impression that they're just, well, there's plenty of food. We can never have a food shortage here in the United States. What they don't understand is that certainly next year it may well be that an awful lot of our farmers are not going to be able to do their planting because, of course, the marked increase in the price of diesel fuel, the fact that what they can actually make for their product, you know, is not going to be going up. And it would actually, in many instances, they would lose money by planting. And, of course, we've even heard from several people that some of the banks are saying, we're not going to lend money to the farmers this coming year because there's no way they're going to be able to pay it back, and we're not going to make loans that we know won't be paid back. And so we could begin to see a real dramatic cutback in farming here in the next year or so if the high price of diesel and gasoline continue. Well, what sort of things should people have on hand, Steve?
Well, obviously, it's always good to have some long-term food storage on hand. Preferably a lot of grains, you know, your rice, your wheat, your beans. Those are make up the basics of your proteins and stuff like that that you need. Dehydrated vegetables are a good way to go. You know, some people want the MREs on hand. But I like to have in some of the dairy products, in your fruits and some psychological foods, even your puddings and desserts and stuff like that are important. A lot of people, if they turn strictly to a very bland diet, all of a sudden they stop eating. And so you kind of need some of that stuff that you would think is frivolous, but really it's important psychologically to have some psychological foods on hand too. But generally your basic grains, you know, and you need your non-fat milk and some oils and salt and stuff like that. Some of that stuff can be purchased locally very cheaply, and it doesn't cost a lot to ship. But some of the other stuff, the dehydrated vegetables, are very light, very inexpensive to ship, and they store best in a number 10 can. It's very convenient. It works better than the buckets, in my opinion, just because of ease of storage. You get a better seal on the can. Anyway, that's what we do, is we have number 10 cans that we seal and then sell them by the can or by the case. There's six cans in a case.
Now, you actually can them yourselves?
Yes. We've had several canneries. We were much more built up during the Y2K thing, obviously, but we still have a canning facility, and we still stock almost 60 different products. Those products are... You can either call us for a brochure, or we're listed on the World Wide Web at Noah's Pantry, NOAHSPANTRY.org, if people are wanting to know how to reference our stuff off of the Internet.
All right, fine. Well, they have a telephone number.
Yes, we have a toll-free number. It's 888-925-6624.
One more time.
888-925-6624. And I'm always here to be able to field questions that people might have at any time. A lot of people might be concerned about stuff they've stored for Y2K and whether it's good and how long will it last. I can answer some of those questions. But in general, your shelf lives on some of this canned products are usually 8, 10, 15 years. And that's if you store it at a, say, 72-degree temperature, and it's not real moist. If you were to store that same food at 82 degrees, you would cut the shelf life in half.
What about having things, wheat in plastic pails? Does it keep pretty well, just the wheat kernels?
Sure it does, very, very well. And again, the heat is the aspect. If it's in a cellar kind of situation where it's 62 degrees, you double the shelf life again. And when I'm talking about shelf life, really you're not going to be harmed by eating a lot of this food, even if it was beyond the shelf life. The nutritional value is just what's falls off. So, you know, you're not like going to be poisoned or something. You're just not going to be getting the nutritional value out of your food if it goes, you know, really, really long, 20, 30, 40 years, that kind of thing.
Now, what about plastic pails? Is there any danger at all of storing things in there? Any way the plastic would come off into the wheat, things like that?
No, I don't think so. Depending on where you keep them, they're not always rodent-proof. You know, big rats and things, believe it or not, can actually eat through some of those plastic buckets, and that's why we don't necessarily recommend them. But they are inexpensive, and for your wheat and grains and beans, sometimes they work out very, very well.
Well, I know the Mormons always used to insist, you know, everybody had a year's supply of food. That was, I can remember, 50 years ago, that was so you knew a Mormon because they always had a large food supply. The Mormons still stressing this, you know?
Very much so. They have their big distribution areas, and I'll be frank, I tutelaged kind of under them and went to some of their large canneries and learned. And they do stress that very much for nuclear attack purposes, but a lot of their parishioners just aren't real faithful at follow-through on that, to be honest.
Well, I remember when Y2K was coming down the line, we went over to the local Mormon cannery, and of course we weren't Mormon at all, but they were very gracious, and they let us in. Then, of course, as we approached Y2K, a lot of the Mormons began getting worried, and so they excluded people who were not Mormons, which was certainly the right to do, look after their own. Certainly it really was sort of a fun thing to do, actually, learning how to actually do the canning for the rice and the wheat, and I've even forgotten all the things we did. Mashed potatoes, remember they had mashed potatoes? And they had
very good mashed potatoes.
And they had grated onions and all these things, you know, that, you know, just would, if you ever did need them. And, you know, people here in the United States could not imagine that the wonderful utopian society we've lived in, you know, could ever end. But, you know, if God is just, he is going to bring judgment on this country. There's no question at all. And I think that people are going to have to recognize that. And, of course, as we remember the story of Joseph, and, of course, when he was in Egypt. And, you know, was told by the Lord there was going to be difficult times. And so they began making preparations. So they stored food and for 7 years. And then there was a great famine for 7 years. And, well, the people there in Egypt, of course, had abundant food. And people from all other rest of the world were coming there, the known world at that time, including Joseph's brothers. Because, of course, they had to have food. And there was no food in Palestine or anywhere else in that area. But the Egyptians had plenty of food because they'd made the preparations. And I sort of like to tell people that story as I encourage them to begin thinking about what the future holds.
I agree. And Christians aren't immune from that. As you could see, God's children themselves were affected by those famines back then.
And I think that the idea that we could never have another famine. Remember, somebody in our government is giving away the massive food supplies that were authorized by Congress, commissioned by Congress, but Congress doesn't know whether they're there or not. And the information we're getting from lots of sources is there's not an awful lot of wheat or grain or other things in the line right here in the United States today. Well, what you also, of course, get into the water and the water aspects and water filtration. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure.
So very often, for instance, we will get requests by people about water fluoridation. Is there any way to get the fluoridated water out of the whole system, or do you have to take it out by individual filters?
Well, you can buy filters exclusively knock out the fluoride. But I'll tell you, you can go to nofluoride.com is a very good website. There are proponents out there that are very against carbonated filters because they think that they're ruining our drinking water and taking all the fluoride out. I've done a little research, and just your basic filters, and I'll even include the gravity filters, we have a lot of contact time with the water and the carbon. And these people who are proponents of having fluoride in your water are against these water filters because they show the statistics that up to 83% of the fluoride is removed just from an average carbon filter.
Well, I want to get the fluoride out of the water.
Absolutely.
I think it's a poison. Certainly the 7,000 employees of the Environmental Protection Agency through their union have petitioned the Environmental Protection Agency to take all water fluoridation out immediately, and not a word of that in the controlled media, but anybody would like to check it out, October 24th, Time Magazine, the article there entitled Not in My Backyard. And they point out the Environmental Protection Agency, the scientists, the employees, the people there who studied the disastrous effects of fluoride. They're saying, stop poisoning our people, and the controlled media has suppressed that. So I certainly would like to get the fluoride out. You're saying, though, that the carbon filters do a pretty good job?
I'm saying they really do a very good job. And of course, all these trihalomethanes are extremely, you know, the volatile organic chemicals that are in our water today are really bad. Shower filtration is an area I'd like to touch on. Most people don't realize that two-thirds of the harmful effects of chlorine come through dermal absorption and inhalation while showering. So a 10-minute shower is equivalent to drinking 1 gallon of that same water. So, you know, people that are drinking good water, but they're still showering that, they really are doing themselves a disservice.
I don't think most people have any idea that that's the case.
No, and a real simple test to prove a lot of this, most people don't realize how absorbent the skin is if you'll go down to a Walmart or somewhere and get a chlorination kit for a pool, it just costs $2.33 to get some what we call OTO. And if you'll take some tap water and put that OTO in there, it'll turn bright yellow or orange, and that's testing for the presence of chlorine. If you'll stick 3 fingers in that water, another cup, for about 20 seconds, and drop those drops in there, you'll see it won't turn yellow or orange, simply illustrating how that chlorine is being absorbed into your skin.
Well, hang on. We'll be back in just a moment with Steve Sawyer to wrap up this part of the program here at Radio Liberty. And if you'd like to give us a call, Give us a call, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and basically what you're saying is that even the chlorine that in the pool will be rapidly absorbed if you have it in a cup of water, and simply you stick your fingers in that water and it's absorbed by your skin?
Very much so. I do a lot of seminars around, and I do this up on stage, and it just you can't believe how many shower filters I sell when I'm done doing that illustration. And another one I do is I kind of put a little bit of it in my mouth and swish it around for 1 second and spit it out. I can put 25 drops in that glass in just a little bit of water, and it will not turn yellow at all. The mouth is very absorbent. But the chlorine is, you know, it mixes with these trihalomethanes out here, you know, these big holding ponds and stuff that have organic matter in it, and that's what you get your cancer-causing agents. And so it's a real problem. Especially down here in Oklahoma, we have a lot of the chicken runoff that has a lot of blooming, you know, the algae and stuff like that. We have huge lawsuits with the poultry industries and stuff because they use that chicken litter on the land, and then it runs off into the creeks, and it's a huge problem down where we're at.
Well, I would think it would be awfully good fertilizer. In other words, it certainly, if it worked into the soil, it would.
Well, it is, but the problem is they put so much on it, the ground gets saturated with it, and eventually it can't hold any more of the manure, and it just literally runs off into the creeks and into the holding lakes down here, and it gets to be a big problem.
In other words, that's why you're suggesting that people do get their water filters or gravity filters or something of sorts, just to make sure the water's clear.
Sure. And then there's the countertop. You know, you have the gravity water systems for your emergency purposes, and those are good. Some women complain that they're on the countertop and they're kind of big and bulky and, you know, cumbersome, but you need to have one of those on hand no matter what. But for everyday usage, sometimes just a countertop model that has a little diverter valve, for $99, they'll do 5,000 gallons of water. And up to 3 to 5 years or 5,000 gallons of water. Very inexpensive way, very convenient way to get your water right out of the tap without having to, you know, let it sit there for, you know, 12 hours or 24 hours to get your water. So there's more inexpensive ways to get clean drinking water than just the emergency water filtering systems. But I think everyone needs a gravity water filter system for sure.
Yeah, well, I think that they certainly are very convenient, and I know we've been very happy with the one we have because we have a good well water, so we don't worry about it. But, you know, in case there was an emergency, why, we would have something that we could fall back on. And that's really the major reason why where we are, because we don't have chlorinated water, and we've never had any problems with the water at all. But certainly there's this uneasy feeling that something serious could happen, and if it did, why, the tragedy is most of us are so dependent upon the structure of society, we wouldn't know what to do. And it's just like it was I was in Germany after the Second World War, and the people there were living in this wonderful society, very well-organized society, and then suddenly their whole society was destroyed by the bombings and the fires, and the people really had great difficulty in coping until sort of after the war. It took them 10 years to get that their country beginning to be rebuilt again. And even still, many of the major cities, when I was there in 1954, 1955, were still primarily rubble. We're going to be back in just a moment here with Steve Sawyer. And I would simply point out, don't say it couldn't happen here, because I really believe that it could. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Steve Sawyer. And Steve, let's get your telephone number and your website out just one more time.
Okay, it's 888-925-6624. Again, 888-925-6624. And the website is Noah's Pantry, NOAHSPANTRY.org.
All right, fine. And certainly Noah's, the primary, I should say, Steve, is quite well versed in various things having to do with water filters and how you can actually be sure that if there were an emergency, you'd be able to have good, clean water. Now, certainly you're in touch with people all across the country who are really providing the food for people. Are they continuing to actually produce the supplies, the alpine food, these other things? Do you carry alpine food?
No, I mean, we're actually the, you know, NOAA's pantry is basically, we buy from large distributors in different parts of the country, you know, potatoes out there in the Utah area and the dairy products up in Wisconsin and the beans in the Midwest and wheat and so on, and then we actually, you know, can everything and then
and what do we do with the potatoes? Do you actually prepare it? Do you dry the potatoes? Or
no, no, we don't do that. We buy them just like that, either sliced, mashed, or whatever, or shredded, and then we can them and package them so it's convenient for you, so you don't have to do that, basically.
All right, and Chris, it's pretty hard, you know, you certainly want to have a whole great big pail full of those things. You'd like to have them in something that you could use for a few days.
Yes, we've got snap-on lids. You know, once you open up a can, you know, you've got a snap-on plastic lid on top of that, and they're in nice sizes. They store real well if you want to, you know, put them in a closet or push them under a bed, you know, the size of the can. They're a little more expensive than the buckets, but the convenience is well worth the extra money, in my opinion.
Well, I think that probably it certainly is, and certainly it's not only in storing, but the once you open them up, why, of course, they're readily available to you, and you don't have them left open where the rats can get into them.
That's correct.
All right, fine. Well, we're just about out of time. Is there any parting thoughts you would like to leave with our listeners this evening?
Oh, I just emphasize, you know, potassium iodate is something that I think is important that people should consider, you know, anytime there's a potential nuclear threat out there, which I think exists, for, you know, $20 a bottle, it's always important to carry some potassium iodate with you.
All right, fine. Well, thank you so very much, and we'll look forward to talking to you later.
Okay.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Stan.
All right. Well, that was Steve Sawyer from NOAA's Pantry. And of course, talking about having potassium iodate on hand, the average individual doesn't think there's any possibility of a nuclear war. And yet we are doing everything we can to build up the nuclear capacity of communist China. And why would we do that when they're doing everything they can to build up their nuclear capacity to lob missiles onto this country? In fact, when the various Chinese generals, not once but a number of times, have talked about the threat of attacking the United States, we're so concerned about what they're doing over in Iran. And, of course, they're basically trying to develop their nuclear capacity and enrich uranium. They say they're just going to enrich the uranium so that they can have nuclear power plants. Maybe they're intending to build a bomb, but we know the Chinese communists are intending to build bombs. And we recently just subsidized through the Export Impact Bank a loan of $5 billion to communist China so they could actually build 5 nuclear power plants, the beginning of some 50 nuclear power plants that will, of course, enrich massive amounts of uranium. And we're going to help them do that. And they can use that in their nuclear missiles that they've already threatened to use to attack America. Now, how can you make any sense out of that? The Chinese communists initially were incapable of targeting their MIRV missiles. They just, every time they tried them, they failed. And then during the Clinton administration, we transferred to them the technology so that they could develop their nuclear weapons so they could target the United States. Why would we do something like that? Well, the explanation that was given was, oh, well, Bill Clinton wanted a campaign contribution. So he gave these nuclear secrets to the Chinese communists because he got $100,000 in campaign contributions. Ladies and gentlemen, Bill Clinton got, I think, $10 million for this, the autobiography he wrote or had somebody else write when he left office. Do you honestly believe he betrayed America for a $100,000 campaign contribution? Or is that what they're telling the American people to justify the fact that we're building up the best enemy money could buy? Well, we're going to have open lines this next half hour. We're going to welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. We don't have anything prepared, so we'd love to hear from you right here at Radio Liberty. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 or... Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we're going to have open lines this next half hour, and then, of course, we're going to have our good friend Derek Skousen with us the last hour of this evening. But let me just simply point out that if you go back and you study the history that led up to the terrible Second World War, and, of course, there were probably between 50 and 60 million people killed, and how many people were injured in addition to that, no one will ever know. But it was a terrible and horrible time in the history of the world, and it was all planned that way, is my contention. Those of you who have never seen the letter I found written by Ambassador Dodd, who was the American ambassador to Berlin during the 1930s. The letter was written in 1936, and it's written to Colonel Edward Mandel House. And, of course, I found this when I spent weeks going through Colonel House's papers back at their Sterling Library there at Yale. And Ambassador Dodd is writing to Colonel House and saying, Colonel, why are the 100 American corporations that are here actually building up the German war machine? Now, we just got through with the First World War. Nobody wants another war. But why are the American corporations building up the German war machine when the corporations can't make any profit because of exchange controls? They can't get any money out of the country. As I read that letter, I was sure that that Ambassador Dodd really didn't understand, because none of it made sense. But I'm sure Colonel House understood, because he was part of the occult hierarchy that ruled the world. He was deeply involved with occultism. He had mystical powers. He could control people's minds, and he had controlled already the Wilson administration. He had controlled the Roosevelt administration, and both of those men did his bidding. Unfortunately, we have these people in our society. They've always been there. There's always somebody who is controlling the president. And, of course, with President Wilson and with President Roosevelt, it was Colonel Edward Mandel House. I suspect it's Dick Cheney, who is currently controlling the current administration, working behind the scenes. If you remember, of course, with the 9-1-1 attack, why Dick Cheney took charge of the government, told the president not to bother to come back, that they might be trying to attack his plane, he better go some other place. And Dick Cheney took control of our society there for a period of time and was giving the orders as to what should be done. So, but under any circumstances, if you study the background to World War II, and certainly if you haven't yet read Professor Sutton's book, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, you'll find that Adolf Hitler was financed, and it was armed, and everything was done to build up the German Wehrmacht, the German military machine, in preparation for World War II. And why would anybody do that unless they wanted a major, major war? Well, this is Dr. Stan. We're going to have open lines for the rest of this half hour. So if you're out across America listening to us, give us a call at 1-800-1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. We'd love to hear from you. But I was simply pointing out that that the United States and American corporations and American banks built up the Wehrmacht, the German war machine, prior to World War II. And even if you read the book, I think it's Charles Hingham's book, Trading with the Enemy, he will point out that even many of our major banks were actually helping to fund the German during World War II, of course, by transferring things into Switzerland, then we transferred it into Hitler, because, you see, to begin with, Hitler didn't have any oil, and so we gave him the patent and the know-how so he could develop oil, that he could actually take coal and convert it into oil. He didn't have any rubber. I mean, how can you have a military without rubber? So, of course, American corporations gave him the patent so that he could develop the nylon and develop rubber for the tires for the trucks to transport their soldiers as they streamed across Europe. And time and time again, why we provided and helped to provide the Germans with the military know-how and with the funding to build up their military. And it really doesn't make sense, unless you understand, that there were people who wanted the war. Have you ever wondered why Rudolf Hess, for instance, flew to England in 1940? Well, he flew to England because he wanted to contact the members of the Round Table, which was a small clique group of people, of Englishmen, and they, of course, were the manifestation of the secret society that Cecil Rhodes had created. And, of course, the organization had been headed by a German named Milner after Cecil Rhodes died. But by the 1930s, the group was known as the Cliveden Set. You can read all about it in Professor Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, which reveals so many of the secrets of the inner circle that ruled the world. That somebody bought up the plates to Tragedy and Hope, Professor Quigley's book, and destroyed them. So that destroyed the plates to the first half of the book so it could never be reprinted, to suppress the information so you would never be able to connect the dots. Well, fortunately, the book is available now. It's printed by a friend of mine. But if you doubt that that somebody would actually buy up a publisher so they could destroy the plates to the first half of Professor Quigley's book, we have an interview with Professor Quigley where he tells that story, an interview I found when I was back at Georgetown University. I believe it was in 1980. And I spent many weeks there going through Professor Quigley's papers at Georgetown, came across an interview he had done with a Washington Post reporter, was able to purchase the right to reproduce that tape from Mrs. Quigley. Professor Quigley was gone at that time. And there, of course, you find out that Professor Quigley talks about how they suppressed his book. Why? Because it told about the secret society that Cecil Rhodes had created that by the 1930s was doing everything they could to encourage Adolf Hitler at every turn. And so American financiers and English financiers financed Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler was encouraged by a group in England. They encouraged him to go into Alsace-Lorraine. They encouraged him to go into Austria. They encouraged him to go into the Sudetenland, which was the northern part of Czechoslovakia. And if you've ever read Albert Speer, of course, was very, very close to Adolf Hitler, and we have his memoirs, and he told about the only time he ever saw Hitler really taken aback was when Hitler was told that England had declared war on him. England and France had declared war after he invaded Poland. He couldn't believe that because he felt that they were working with him. They were encouraging him at every turn. He had no idea that suddenly they would declare war on him because he'd invaded Poland. And you have to understand that when Hitler invaded Poland from the west, why Stalin invaded Poland from the east. But England and France did not declare war on Stalin and Germany. They just declared war on Germany. Why? Because they wanted a war. This has always been the plan. You needed a war if we were going to build the New World Order. And this was a wonderful opportunity. You see, they had failed with the First World War. The purpose of the First World War was to bring about the world government. And the world government was to be the League of Nations. And after the terrible First World War, with probably 21 million people dead, 12 million soldiers, and about it was 8 million soldiers and about 12 million civilians died. It was about 21 million people had died, and then probably twice that many people were injured, casualties. People of Europe were willing to accept a world government at that time and willing to give up their national sovereignty and establish the League of Nations. And it was only because of the United States Senate's objection to the League of Nations that it failed. But there have always been people who wanted a world government. And so it was that they did everything they could to bring about World War II. You have to understand that the United States was doing everything they could to build up Japan prior to the Second World War, despite the fact that they had invaded China and, of course, the rape of Nanking and the brutal treatment of the people in both Korea and in China. Why, America was shipping them all sorts of war materials and all sorts of scrap metal and all the things that they would need to build up their military and extending them credits. And then, of course, when it became obvious now was the time to have the war, suddenly America put an embargo on Japan so they couldn't buy raw materials anywhere in the world, so they couldn't borrow money, but most so they couldn't buy oil anywhere in the world. Now, what would happen if somebody put an oil embargo on the United States today? why it would be an act of war. We could not survive without oil because we're totally dependent on other countries that form 60% of the oil we utilize here in America. But Japan was dependent 100% on the oil that it imported from other countries, dependent upon it for its electricity, dependent upon it for to keep its manufacturing running, it dependent upon it for its military, and then its ships burned oil. And America, as an act of war, a unilateral act of war against Japan, cut off their supply of oil, intentionally knowing full well this would precipitate an attack by the Japanese. In fact, we have, I found back at the Sterling Library, where Secretary of War Stimson's diary is kept, and we have the pages, and we'll make them available to any one of you who would like to read them. And Secretary of War Stimson went to the White House on the 25th of November, and of course it's all typed out in his diary, and he said, you know, we met with the president, and the president said that he anticipated the Japanese would attack the following Monday, which would have been the just about the end of November. And if the only question was how we were going to get into the war and get the Japanese to fire the first shot. Now, President Roosevelt, of course, had to tell the American people that we had no idea the war was coming. The day of infamy, the wicked Japanese attacked the United States. The truth of the matter was they knew exactly where the Japanese Navy was. They knew that they were going to attack Pearl Harbor, and they left those boys there to die because they felt it was a greater good. If you have not yet heard our four-tape set on Pearl Harbor, interviews with them, Admiral Thomas Moore, who was, of course, head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in later life, but he was a fighter pilot at Pearl Harbor that morning, and my two-hour interview with the gentleman who wrote The Day of Deceit, my one-hour interview with John Tolan, who wrote a book about Pearl Harbor entitled Infamy. You need to get those four tape sets to understand there is no question the government knew the attack was coming and left the boys there to die and lied to the American people to get us into World War II. The purpose of World War II was not to defeat tyranny throughout the world. In fact, we embraced the communists at the end of the Second World War and turned Eastern Europe and China over to them. The purpose of the Second World War was to bring about the United Nations and a world government. You could not convince the American people. There are people in the United States today who still want to maintain our sovereignty, who do not want to give up their freedom, who do not want to give up our Constitution. And that is why I believe we will have World War III. You see, this has always been the goal of the ancient mystery religions. And if you doubt that, you really need to read some of the writings of the people who are disciples of the ancient mystery religions. People like old Manly P. Hall, in his book, The Secret Destiny of America, will tell you that for over 3,000 years, the disciples of the mystery religions have been working to bring about a world democratic state. And he talks about and this book is written in the 1920s, that's The Secret Destiny of America by Manly P. Hall. Manly P. Hall was a Satanist, our friend Bill Sneblin. He used to talk about how, of course, Manly P. Hall would appear as an apparition. And of course, Sneblin was deeply involved with Satanism at the time, and he was under the tutelage of Manly P. Hall. And Manly P. Hall certainly was telling him about the coming Third World War. This was in the early 1980s. Only the war was began in the year 2002, or at least the war with Saddam Hussein was to begin in 2002, and it didn't occur until 2003. But the significant thing is that they have been planning this Third World War for a long period of time, and we're doing everything today we can to build up communist China. We're doing everything we can today to build up communist Russia. And I hate to tell you this, ladies and gentlemen, but communism is not dead. The communists are still in key control of the KGB. They've changed its name, but nothing has changed. They're still control of the Russian army. They're still control of the framework of the Russian government. The Duma is controlled by communists. Putin is a lifelong communist. In fact, the former dictator of Russia, Mikhail Gorbachev, has offices right here in the United States. And when he puts on meetings here, Why? Who attends his meetings? We have the list of attendees. People like Mabiki. Who's Mabiki? He's the president of South Africa that we installed there to replace Nelson Mandela. Men like George Herbert Walker Bush, James Baker III, the George Shultz. We have the list of all the people who go to these meetings. The rulers of the world attend Mikhail Gorbachev's meetings. Why? Well, because behind everything that's going on today are powerful spiritual forces. And according to a book we carry called Extraordinary Beings, Extraordinary Times by Wayne Peterson, who is part of the occult movement that rules the world. Although he is a very, very low-level occultist who is living in Henderson, Nevada today, waiting for the appearance of Lord Maitreya, who is the Christ of the occultists, of the people from the dark side. But he tells you how Mikhail Gorbachev is one of the leaders of this whole movement. And Mikhail Gorbachev is deeply involved with the occult. And that is why Mikhail Gorbachev is paid homage by the leaders of this country, the lower levels of of this whole world movement. Mikhail Gorbachev, along with Stephen Rockefeller and Marie Strong, a multi-billionaire, have written the Earth Charter, which is the new Ten Commandments that is stored today in the Earth Charter, in the Ark of Hope, which is, in my estimation, the satanic counterpart of the Ark of the Covenant. The Earth Charter, which is the new Ten Commandments for the world, is stored in the Ark of Hope, which is the, in my opinion, satanic counterpart of the Ark of the Covenant. So here, of course, we're told that communism is dead, and yet here we find Mikhail Gorbachev working with Marie Strong, a multi-billionaire, working with Stephen Rockefeller, who comes from a family that has literally hundreds of billions of dollars, if not trillions of dollars. And why is that? Well, because there's spirits of forces that energize this whole movement towards world government and are moving us rapidly towards World War III. The United States today, and people in the United States, are doing everything possible to build up the military capacity of Communist China. Why are we lending massive amounts of money to Communist China today? If you read the Wall Street Journal as I do, you'll find American banks, European banks, are pouring massive amounts of money, tens of billions of dollars, into China's economy, and China is in full military production for war. In fact, they massively increased their outlays for military preparedness. And the same thing is happening in Russia today. And major American corporations and major American oil companies and Shell Oil are pouring billions of dollars to build up the infrastructure of Russia. And that Russia infrastructure will be used to finance Russia's military development. In fact, today they are building new intercontinental mobile ballistic missiles. We don't have any intercontinental mobile ballistic missiles, but they have them in Russia. Russia has massive stores of food to feed its people when the next war comes. And they've gotten from America through the years massive amounts of wheat that we've actually sold them at discounted prices or actually almost given to them. Why would we have done that? Russia is preparing for war. Russia has a massive program of civil defense to protect its people when the nuclear war comes. Do we have anything comparable in this country? Absolutely not. I've been to meetings that were attended by people from the federal government dealing with civil defense, and when asked, they say, we have no program to defend the American people in case of a nuclear war. Oh, and that's why, of course, when we talk about having certainly things like Geiger counters to protect yourself and your family and potassium iodide and supplies on hand, could you imagine what one nuclear bomb would do to this country, to our financial structure, what it would do to basically our ability to have transportation in this country? They could actually set off a nuclear device in space and knock out all of our electronics in this country and our computers. People say it could never happen here, and I would say, why couldn't it happen here? If God is just, his justice will not sleep forever. And I really fear for our country because I believe God is just, and I believe tragically we have people in positions of leadership who are moving us rapidly towards World War III. And we've got Laverne calling from Spokane, Washington. Laverne, how are you tonight?
I'm fine. And Dr. Stan, I tucked away this this statement from Abraham Lincoln. Every time I listen to your program, this comes to mind. And Abraham Lincoln said, "I have faith in the people. The danger is in their being misled. Let them know the truth, and the country is safe." That's why your program is so important.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. God bless. Another thing he said is, you know, let's see, how does that go?
He said, "I have faith in the people. The danger is in their being misled. Let them know the truth, and the country is safe." That's powerful.
Amen. Well, we need first to get the truth out, and sin by silence when we should protest makes cowards of men. God bless you, Laverne, and thank you so very much for... anything else you want to say before we let you go?
No, I just want to thank you for your program. I don't miss it unless I have to.
God bless. Good night. And please tell all the other people up there in Spokane about it, will you?
I sure do.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, there's, of course, another very, very famous saying by Abraham Lincoln, which has always been one of my favorites. He said, "At what point should we expect the approach of danger? By what means should we fortify ourselves against it? Should we expect some transatlantic giant to step the ocean and crush us with a blow? Never. All the armies of Europe and Asia and Africa combined could never by force take a drink from the Ohio or make a mark on the Blue Ridge, not in the trial of 1,000 years. Then at what point should danger be expected? And I answer, if it ever reaches, it must spring up among us. It can never come from abroad. If destruction be our lot, then we ourselves must be its authors and its finishers. As a nation of free men, we shall live through all time or die by suicide." At what point should we expect the approach of danger? And I answer, if it ever reaches, it must spring up among us, it can never come from abroad. If destruction be our lot, then we ourselves must be its authors and its finishers. As a nation of free men, we shall live through all time or die by suicide. And ladies and gentlemen, the threat to America does not come from communist China or communist Russia, because both of them are being financed from right here in the United States. The threat to America comes from within our own country. And there have been here in the United States, going back to the 1640s and 1650s, wicked men who were sent to America by Francis Bacon and, of course, the people who he was in contact with. Francis Bacon, I think, died about 1627, 1630, somewhere in there. But he was part of a Rosicrucian group, and these people were sent to America to take over control of our country and to use the wealth and the power of the United States to bring about a world government. That's all told in the story by Manly Hall, entitled "The Secret Destiny of America." We've got Jonathan calling from Southern California. Hi, Jonathan. How are you doing?
Hi. How are you?
I'm doing fine. We're just about out of time. Do you have a quick question?
Well, I want to make a comment, actually, because I hear you talking about nuclear weapons and nuclear war, and I've made a study of it at one time. And first of all, a lot of people don't realize that the weapons that they have now deployed and armed and aimed and cocked are geometrically stronger than the weapons that they dropped in Japan.
Right.
People don't realize that, you know, first of all, not only that, but also, of course, they have several of them on one missile. And, you know, if one of them landed on New York City, it would make 9/11 look like popcorn.
Hold that thought for just a moment here, because we're going to have to bring our stasis back. Well, we've got Jonathan calling from Southern California, and of course he's expressing his concern about the possibility of nuclear weapons and pointing out, of course, that they've merged our weapons. In other words, they have multiple targeted reentry vehicles. So one missile could give you 10 warheads, and those 10 warheads would be disseminated, and as he said, one nuclear weapon. Certainly dropped on New York City would make 9/11 look like a tea party. And I agree with you, Jonathan, and this is why I try to be sounding the alarm, because people believe it can't happen here. I believe it not only can happen, I believe it will happen. Well, if you read the scriptures, everything points to the fact that we are going to see fire coming from the sky.
Right, but it's not only that. It's also people don't remember or people aren't aware of the so-called doomsday scenario or the mutual assured destruction philosophy, whereby if one of those things landed anywhere at this point, I believe, on the Earth, that would be the death knell.
I don't think it's really mutual assured destruction. I think it's just assured destruction of America, because the other countries have made preparations. We have no preparations. Hey, Jonathan, we're out of time.
Okay.
Call me again, because I'd love to talk to you more about it, but right now I've got to let you go.
Thank you.
God bless, and thanks for calling. Well, this is the time when I really have to remind our listeners out across America that Radio Liberty is primarily listener supported, and we really depend upon those of you who listen to our programs to help us. And so we hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And so give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we need to remind you that we are having an all-day seminar. It's going to be on the 19th of November right here in the Monterey Bay area at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course. And we, of course, have to know if you're coming, because we're going to be serving lunch. So you're going to have to give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And people are beginning now. Of course, it looks like we're going to get a real good crowd, and more people are signing up. A good number signed up today. And we hope that you'll be able to come. We're bringing in speakers, one from Illinois, one from Northern California. And so if you possibly can make it, November 19th, all-day seminar, the annual Radio Liberty Seminar at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course. Again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we suggest you go to our website at www.radioliberty.com. And if you have a computer, of course, you can listen to our programs directly or indirectly, 5 hours a day on the Internet. You won't get much accomplished, but you'll certainly get a lot of information that you can share with others. Because this is how we're going to be able to reach people. And fortunately, this evening program will be heard on about 30 stations. Now, we're a pretty small fry compared with a lot of, but certainly we have a small network put together. The program is actually rebroadcast 2 weeks from now, so this information will be heard in the Middle West. And now we're beginning to begin to reach people in that area, which is exciting. A whole new audience of people who've never heard the truth before. But remember, we're involved in a spiritual battle. So please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers. But please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision, and for our protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Please hold your calls until we ask for them, because right now we have us on the line, Derek Skousen. And Derek comes from World Affairs Brief. It's Joel Skousen's son. And Derek is certainly one of our favorite guests, has a great deal of information, and keeps up to date and keeps our listeners up to date on what's really going on behind the scenes. And, of course, if you read World Affairs Brief, as I do first thing every morning when I get up after I've done my emails, why, you'll find out what's being said in Asia and the India Times, what's being said in Europe, what is being said throughout the world, and you'll learn a lot more about what's going on in America from reading foreign sources than you ever will by reading the controlled media in America, because they can conceal anything they want to here. And you must understand, when they suddenly blow up this indiscretion on the part of Mr. Liddy, who is the assistant to Dick Cheney, that's because they want you to focus your attention on that. The really important stories and some of the terrible things that have happened here, and frank murders and assassinations, are totally controlled by the media. So we are allowed to see and hear and think what they want us to think. But you can think independently if you check World Affairs Brief every morning, and of course if you listen to Radio Liberty and listen to Derek Skousen. Good evening, Derek. How are you doing tonight?
Doing well, thank you, Dr. Stan.
Well, why don't you pick up the story, and I'm just going to let you tell us about what's going on in the world.
Well, this week, President Bush came up with a new nomination to replace Sandra Day O'Connor on the Supreme Court. And basically, this is his administration reeling from the backlash of choosing what was essentially an unqualified White House crony, Harriet Myers, to replace the former Justice O'Connor, or the current Justice O'Connor. And the nomination, of course, as you may have heard, is Samuel Alito Jr. And Alito was chosen specifically to placate the core conservative constituency of President Bush. And he was chosen specifically for his appearance of conservatism. And what we've been analyzing here at the World Affairs Brief this week is really what his record is so far and the information that we have. And it's been very interesting to analyze the news throughout the United States as they've been trumpeting the amount of conservative record that Alito has. And yet, as we really look at it from the perspective of the World Affairs Brief, it creates a variety of concerns. In other words, it seems like Alito, it's kind of summarize here at the beginning, that Alito is mostly a conservative in name only, and that he seems to lack the broad-based conservative principle orientation that is necessary to withhold or to hold up the standard of liberty in these trying times.
And I certainly, why would we expect we would get a conservative from the Bush administration, which did everything they could to destroy Judge Roy Moore, the Ten Commandments judge, and even rewarded William Pryor, who was the man who destroyed Judge Roy Moore, by giving William Pryor an interim appointment to the appellate court. Why would we expect George Bush, who says he's pro-life and yet has not saved one child from abortion, why would he expect that he would put a pro-life constitutional judge on the bench? And nobody ever wants to ask that question. Because, you see, reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. We'll be back in just a moment here with Derek Skousen to explore more of this fascinating subject. Well, Derek, go ahead and pick up the story. In other words, you're very concerned that maybe he is not as pro-life as we've been led to believe, and maybe that explains why some of the Democrats are rallying to his position?
Yes. In fact, we are seeing that that Alito is not as strongly conservative in principle as President Bush and actually the media, news media throughout the United States would like us to believe. So far, as we examine Alito's record here at the World Affairs Brief, he looks very moderate on the surface, and underneath he has some distinct liberal tendencies. And the media is working hard, in fact, to dredge up from his 15 years of experience on the bench the kind of things that would promote his conservative tendencies. And so as we analyze a lot of these things, we see that in general his 15 years on the bench have been marked by, MSNBC calls it strong conservatism on a case-by-case basis that avoids sweeping opinions on constitutionality. And a statement like that raises red flags to us here at the World Affairs Brief, because that comment indicates that he won't defend Constitution in a strict construction sense, but since he avoids any kind of principle-oriented beliefs on constitutionality, but that he will go forward in a technical sense and take things on a case-by-case basis.
And I really think that we should note that many of the so-called the phony conservative Christian leaders we have, and these are people who profess to be Christians and conservative, and yet, of course, they're always on the wrong side on the very important issues, and they're all rallying behind this new nominee. And when we begin to see some of the Democrats rallying to his position, people who are certainly pro-choice Democrats, we have to ask ourselves, why are they backing this man? Why would even the pro-choice Republicans like Arlen Specter be favorably impressed? And is it possible that Harriet Myers was simply a red herring and that the real purpose was to get this candidate in? And we're just so relieved to have a real conservative going in there. We'll never bother to take a look at his record. I think you're absolutely right. I'm so glad you are analyzing this, Derek.
So what we're actually analyzing specifically are the cases that the media is actually trumpeting, and they're kind of the sample cases for Americans to say, oh, gee, Alito is a real conservative. He's pro-life. He's pro-religion. He's very conservative on all the key issues. And yet, as we see his arguments,
hold that thought right there. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Derek Skousen from World Affairs Brief. And Derek is just saying that if you analyze very carefully his decisions on the bench, why there's a lot of question as to whether he is really a conservative constitutionalist or he's sort of a constitutionalist in name only.
So let's continue looking at, for example, the story from MSNBC this week, who... they mentioned that in 1997, Alito authored a majority opinion that upheld the city's right to stage a holiday display that included a nativity scene and a menorah, because the city also included secular symbols and a banner emphasizing the importance of diversity. Now, in general, conservatives would say, gee, finally we have a judge who is allowing the city to display, something like a nativity scene. But what's interesting is that Alito did not have the courage to defend it on the core issue, which is that which is basically the Constitution only enjoins the federal interference in religion, and the Constitution only prohibits the establishment of a state church. It's not that God or religion cannot be recognized by government, and we need a judge, a real conservative judge, would stand up for that key principle.
And, of course, the principle is that what the Congress shall have nothing to do with establishment of religion. That didn't mean the states couldn't, didn't mean that the cities couldn't, didn't mean the counties couldn't. It was a limitation placed on the power of the federal government, so we would not have a national religion. And yet, at the time our Constitution was ratified, I think 9 of the 13 states had an official state religion. We always dealt with matters dealing with religion at the state and at the local level. And you fought the battles there. But, of course, what the federal government has done is come out actively against God mentioned any place in any city or school or county institution. And yet, of course, every single one of our state constitutions mentions God. How can that be if there's a wall of separation between church and state? Very simply, because there isn't any wall. It was created by judges who hate Christianity. There's a conspiracy against Christianity, and it goes to the very highest levels of our Supreme Court. And the question is, are we going to put a man in there who will stand by the Constitution, or a man who will simply go along with the agenda? What are your thoughts there, Derek?
I think that that you're right, Dr. Stan, that and what we should be seeing here is, as we examine Alito's record, is that if Alito was a true conservative, he would understand that that concept that you just explained, that the federal government and the government, especially at the state and local level, should be allowed to recognize God or religion as they have throughout throughout the history of our country, and should be able to, if they are a true conservative, stand up and defend that strongly. And we are not seeing that in Alito's record.
Okay, very good. So I think we should all be very, very concerned that once again we're being led down the garden path, as it were.
That's right. But this is a very this is a much more subtle argument that is being put before us. And Alito is very much going to stand up there and represent the conservative cause. But as we look throughout the information and as things are being put up, we're seeing that he has never really used the strong conservative arguments. He's never really stood up and defended strongly. MSNBC points to the case that in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, in which Alito was a sole defender in the Third Circuit Court, which struck down a Pennsylvania law requiring women seeking abortions to consult their husbands. So this was an abortion-related case that Alito was wrote an opinion on, and it was the dissenting opinion against a judgment that eventually went in the pro-abortion direction. But as we analyze here at the World Affairs Brief, his opinion on that, we see that his reasoning was very weak. And rather than defend the right to life outright, and even to defend a husband's right to have a say in the family matters, he only argued that that it might be nice to talk about this first. And they called that his strong dissenting opinion for abortion.
In other words, a husband ought to talk to his wife, or the wife ought to talk to her husband, but she would still have the final say.
That's right. She would still have the final say, and he did not come out and strongly say that abortion is wrong.
Right. Abortion is murder, and there's no way that you can put it in any other perspective, and you have to understand the spiritual component of this effort to destroy human life. And you cannot... They know exactly what they're doing. They just want the public to know that.
So, throughout the media, as they've been discussing Alito and his position, there have been comparisons with Rehnquist and Scalia. I think that should be a concern to true constitutionalists and to true conservatives. Scalia and Rehnquist are mentioned as being kind of the conservative side of the Supreme Court bench right now, but both of those can be rather unprincipled and concentrating more on the technicalities rather than the broad purpose of the Constitution. And we really are seeing this in Alito, that he is conservative only in a technicality way and not in, he's technically conservative but not principally conservative. And I think the American people expect someone to stand up for their principles and for their beliefs, and Alito will not do that and has not done that. He simply stands conservatively on the technicalities of law.
What a great tragedy that is. And I think it's another interesting thing is that we will have five Catholics on the Supreme Court. Why isn't it we don't have one Protestant on the Supreme Court? And I think that sometimes many Catholics are very, very good people. And if they really believe in the divinity of Jesus Christ, why, we worship the same Savior. But where is the outcry from, certainly from our people saying, look, we've got five Catholics on the Supreme Court, not one Protestant, not one evangelical, but five Catholics. And I will tell you, one of the most interesting experiences I ever had was having an opportunity to interview a well-known Catholic professor from Notre Dame University, professor of law, who had always taken a strong position against the capital punishment, except when the Pope came out and saying that capital punishment was wrong, he immediately reversed himself and went along with the Pope rather than standing on what he felt was right, which was capital punishment was correct. And when I asked him, why did you change your position? He said, well, because the Pope is much smarter than I am. And this has nothing to do with what the Pope says. It's a matter of law and the law of this country. And yet, sometimes people will follow what they're told by their church rather than go by what the Constitution says. And I am somewhat concerned about that.
That's right. There's a tremendous amount of room in the Constitution to pick up the strong conservative arguments that allow us to defend our liberty in the long term. And we are not getting the impression here at the World Affairs Brief that Samuel Alito will grasp a hold of those arguments and push forward the kinds of movement and engender the kind of movement towards bringing our country around back towards liberty.
All right, fine. I share your concerns, and I hope every one of our listeners shares those concerns.
So let's move on to the other big story here inside the United States that has been the topic of discussion throughout the last week, and that is, of course, the indictment of Louis Libby and the insight that we are starting to see into Cheney's interworkings and workings behind the scenes of government, wherein a vice president is basically leading this country behind the president, and the vice president himself seems to be the person who is pushing the direction of this country over the past 6 years, and this is a level of power that is much greater than the vice president has ever had. No other vice president in history has had this kind of role where they have put out the foreign policy of the United States and have taken our country to war and have lied to the American people and have essentially changed the whole direction of how our country is viewed with the rest of the world in such a short amount of time.
I share your concern, but what really bothers me is, Derek, why did they let this whole thing with Liddy come out? It's almost as if this whole thing is scripted to bring out the corruption of Cheney and of the Bush administration. It's almost as if there's sort of a script here that is going to bring them down. What do you make of it?
Well, one of the things that we've been talking about here in the World Affairs Brief over the last couple of months and years is this strong direction of an agenda to build up hatred against the United States, and this hatred is being built up throughout all the countries outside, and we are seeing that through a variety of means. I mean, part of that, we saw it today as President Bush visited the country of Argentina, and tens of thousands of people marched in the streets, expressing horror and shock and hatred at the things that the Bush administration has done. We are seeing riots in Paris for 8 days now, and in Denmark with the Muslim countries that are expressing hatred at the way that the Western countries have under the leadership of the United States treated them. And so we think that that part of this exposure of these inner workings of this cabal is to build that up.
And I share your concerns about that. I think that there is growing hatred to America. And I'm offended by this because I love this country and I love what it stands for. But we're doing everything we can to antagonize the Muslim world and the people in Africa and the people in South America and certainly the people in China and Russia. Why would anybody intentionally try to engender hatred against their own country unless there's another agenda out there? We'll be back in just a moment with Derek Skousen to explore that and so many other ideas here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Derek Skousen. Derek, pick up the story.
So let's continue trying to answer the question of why is it that this information is being allowed to leak out about Libby and about the inner workings of the Cheney staff as they are directing unconstitutionally the direction of America. And there are several different parts of it. One is simply there is so much work that is having to be done to push forward this agenda at such a rapid pace that it is normal to consider that something is going to leak out. You simply just can't keep everything perfect the whole time. And when you have someone as strong-armed as Cheney going through and pushing through the policy in the way that he does, even to the point of regime change in Iraq and billions upon billions of dollars of taxpayer funds going to support a long-term and indefinite-term war, there is going to be some fallout from that process. And that is exactly what we saw here with the case of Valerie Plame and her husband as Cheney basically pushed too hard on one particular point, and it broke down in a way that was probably a little bit unexpected within the Cheney's administration and within his staff.
Well, don't you think it's really the attitude of the position, we're going to get anybody who disagrees with it, we're going to destroy them, we're going to destroy Ambassador Wilson and his wife, Valerie Plame, we're going to out her, and boy, they'll be sorry that they ever tried to, go against us. Do you think this was simply a matter of power play and they didn't realize the implications? Is that possible? Because certainly there's no question that they've done everything they could to destroy the reputation of anybody else who's ever tried to tell the truth about what happened on 9/11 or the background to why we attacked Iraq.
Exactly. And in other words, what we see is that this was a standard process and a standard tactic by Cheney and his staff was to destroy the reputations of people who got in their way. And it's something that they probably did so often and in so many cases that they probably forgot that there was this covert agent in the CIA process they thought that they could get away with it because they have been getting away with it. And they've probably gotten away with it dozens, maybe even hundreds of times over the past 6 years. And it's just that this one particular one opened them up for a little bit more than they were expecting.
But the thing that's always bothered me, Derek, is why would they allow an independent investigator? Why didn't they simply get somebody in there who'd cover this thing up like Kenneth Starr did, never going after the real issues as far as Bill Clinton was concerned? Why would they put in a man who really appeared to be trying to do a good, honest job? Doesn't make sense. And when it appeared that he was going to do a good, honest job, why didn't they discredit and fire him?
Well, we see a variety of trends coming out from this investigation, and of course it is a standard process for the U.S. government to put out to put together a grand jury and to start the process of an investigation whenever something shows up. Of course, as we've seen throughout the course of history over the last decade or so, that all of these investigations and the grand juries and the special prosecutors end up covering up more than they actually expose.
Well, that's off right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Derek is going into the background of the special investigator that Patrick Fitzgerald, I think was his name, that was appointed to investigate the Valerie Plume affair. And I asked the question, look, why would they put in a man who was honest? I mean, they could have gotten a Kenneth Starr who would cover up the real issues as far as Bill Clinton was concerned, never get the really important issues, I mean, get off on the Monica Lewinsky bet, instead of going after the China Gate, going after, the assassinations, so many things that they could have gone after Bill Clinton for, and they didn't. Kenneth Starr covered that up. So why didn't they get somebody else to do the same thing as far as the Valerie Plume affair was concerned? And why, when the Patrick Fitzgerald was getting close to really, indicting Liddy, why didn't they simply replace him or begin to discredit him or do everything they could to make him, appear to be inadequate or vindictive or... But he's getting a good press from the media. He's looking like the real hero in shining armor. So why have they allowed this thing to get as far as it has, which can be a serious embarrassment to the Bush administration? And if somebody hadn't wanted it, why, it never would have gotten this far. So there's got to be some other force behind this thing that is letting it go ahead, don't you think?
That's right. And what we ought to learn is that the number one rule of damage control is to admit a small mistake so that you can cover up a series of larger mistakes in the process. And that is exactly what happened with Kenneth Starr, where they avoided and covered up a series of large mistakes by Bill Clinton, very serious potential charges, and ended up narrowing it down to a silly Lewinsky scandal. And what we're seeing here with the Valerie Plame case is that Fitzgerald has narrowed down the investigation into this process from a potential indictment that reaches not only to Libby but beyond, all the way up to the vice president and throughout, and even reaching, jumping the line and going over to the staff of the Bush presidency itself.
You mean Karl Rove, of course.
Karl Rove, that's right. And even getting very, very close to President Bush himself. And so there is definitely a trend to back away from the real potential of this investigation and where it can go, and actually leading public opinion to understand what really happened as the Bush administration lied to the American people about the Iraq war. You will see that indictment will never come. That indictment will never fall out, and all we see is, well, Scooter Libby, Scooter Libby's gone, and now we have someone else.
In other words, basically, this is a great diversion to keep us from focusing our attention on the really important issues that are for us, and that is, why did they lie to take us into this war? They had obviously been planning the war with Iraq long before the 9/11 attack, and one only has to read Paul O'Neill's book. He was the Secretary of Treasury's book, The Price of Loyalty. He tells you that 6 or 7 months before the 9/11 attack, they were already planning on the preemptive attack. So how were they going to justify a preemptive attack on Iraq? But we can't let the American people realize that this has nothing to do with the fact Saddam Hussein was an evil man, because we'd backed him all during the 1980s. We financed him, this wicked, evil man who was killing his own people, millions of them, if what we're told is true, and no question he was a mass murderer, but he was backed by the people in our government. So, but then, of course, now we want to go to war with him because he's an evil man. Why don't we hold the people responsible for who kept him in power? And if you've read the book, which we carry, called A See No Evil by Robert Baer, a CIA agent working in Iraq pointed out that time, at least on two occasions, the Iraqi military tried to overthrow Saddam Hussein and we wouldn't let them. And then we go to war. Something's wrong with this whole story, unless there's another agenda behind what's going on. I think that's a great explanation, Derek. It's simply a diversion. I think it's a very, very good explanation.
This is sophisticated damage control that is being done by the powers that be, they're also giving the Democrats the chance to kind of stand up and stomp their feet and make a bit of noise and point their fingers at the people that they are planning to, the people in the party that they're planning to run against during the next election. And yet we are not seeing the real issue coming to the American people about what will be going on.
I fear that it's going to be difficult to elect a Republican dog catcher in the year 2006. And not that certainly I think the Republicans are going to save us. But certainly I don't want to back the Democrats. I don't want to back either side, because they're both dedicated to globalism. They're both dedicated to the destruction of our sovereignty. They're both dedicated to the New World Order and the imposition of a new world religion on the world. We'll be back in just a moment with Derek Skousen as we explore of the World Affairs Brief and what's really going on. The information you're never going to hear from Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity or the opinion molders here in America. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Derek, go ahead, pick up the story.
So let's continue on here and talk about what has happened now that Libby has resigned. Well, basically, right after Libby resigned, Vice President Dick Cheney, moving swiftly, named attorney David Addington as his chief of staff, as well as John Hanna as his national security advisor. We should understand that Louis Libby, Scooter Libby, had been filling both positions of chief of staff and national security advisor with John Hanna as assistant national security advisor. So basically, John Hanna has just kind of moved from doing the national security advisor role on the side to doing it full time and kind of being the front man for that. So we are certainly not going to see any policy change about from the national security. All of those national security issues and problems and concerns that we've been talking about for the last 6 years here at the World Affairs Brief and that you've been talking about on Radio Liberty are still going to be put up and built by the same people, the same team that was there before. Now, David Addington, the new chief of staff, the official replacement for Scooter Libby, is a more a dangerous person, I believe, because of his background. He was formerly the chief legal counsel for the vice president's staff. And as chief legal counsel, he was a key person in the development of such legal arguments that we consider to be very dangerous, such as those used to shield Cheney from demands by Congress and its investigative agencies to keep people from learning about Cheney's role in with the energy industry lobbyists to uncover his connections and potential manipulations with Halliburton contracts, etc. Those were all blocked by legal arguments written by David Addington. He also was one of the authors of the famous White House memo that critics said justified the use of torture on terrorism suspects. And so now this person has been promoted to the chief of staff position and will have an even stronger hold on the future policy of America as it moves forward.
The more things change, the more they remain the same.
Exactly. I couldn't say it better, Dr. Stan. That is the key takeaway from what is happening throughout this Libby Cheney scandal, as it may be, is that it may sound like there's this big shakeup going on in the Bush administration, but in fact, there is a hunkering down, and they are digging their roots in.
Hold that thought right there just for a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Derek's point is that certainly the new man who's taken Liddy's place seems to be cut from even a worse bolt of cloth than the former one. He had authorized torture of captured troops. That everybody thinks things are getting shaken up there. It seems like they're consolidating their control. They dissuaded the American people. Now we have another issue that distract our attention to keep us away from the really important issues. And they're so clever and be able to, focus our attention on the wrong issue. It's sort of like the sleight of hand fellow. You know, he wants to deceive you, so you're watching the one hand. But it's with the other hand, of course, he's stealing your wallet. So pick up the story there, Derek.
So basically, Libby has been indicted, and because of the unindictment, it will go to trial. And there's a little bit of hope on our part that we will continue to learn more about the interworkings of these secret machinations of people who are working behind government to shape the policy and to push forward this agenda. We've seen this global agenda roll forward over the last many decades here at the World Affairs Brief, and it's always valuable for us to collect and piece out the information that leaks out through the news about how that actually works. How is it that people are gaining power and growing power and pushing that power throughout the world? and see the implementations of these policies. But other than that, we don't have very many hopes that the trial of Louis Libby will actually be a great blow for us and for justice and liberty in the future, because as we are seeing that the judge that has been assigned to the Libby case has links to the Bush administration. U.S. District Judge for D.C. Reggie Walton has been assigned to the Louis Libby case. Walton, as you may or may not know, was the judge who, under pressure from the Justice Department, placed a gag order on former FBI translator and whistleblower Sybil Edmonds, and cleared his courtroom of the public and the media in Edmonds' hearing in her case against the FBI. Of course, Edmonds was the gal who brought to light a lot of the important information about how the FBI failed to translate wiretap intercepts before and after 9/11.
But she seemed to think that they had all the information that they possibly needed to know that the attack was coming, and that's one reason why, of course, she was not allowed to testify publicly before the 9/11 Commission, and certainly why she was not allowed in her lawsuit to bring what she knew out. And she's been placed on a gag order to keep her from telling the American people the truth. And if there's nothing to conceal about what they knew before 9/11 about the coming attack, why are they muzzling Sybil Edmonds?
And the person who muzzled Sybil Edmonds is the same person who is supposed to prosecute Louis Libby.
Well, I'm sure we'll have a fair trial.
So we are guaranteed actually to see that that there will be protection of the Bush administration and the processes through the courts. And that we will see a minimum, amount of trial there and information from that.
Okay, fine. Well, I think it's fascinating for our listeners to begin to understand the machinations that go behind the scenes and how they manipulate our emotions and focus our attention on the wrong things.
So let's continue with a couple more stories that I think help to illustrate how the media manipulates public opinion. And much of the manipulation of public opinion is the way that the media invents different people to be on different sides of an issue, as if these people had long principled-based arguments to stand on different sides of the debate. In many cases, we're seeing that that these people are not principally oriented; they just stand up there and act as if they're on opposite sides of the table. But when in reality, they're all controlled by the same agenda. And, of course, the largest and most classic example of that is the Republicans versus the Democrats. But an interesting example of that is in the media today and among the media itself, that we kind of have in the media this Western media and American media that places itself against the media sides that are kind of more, how should we say, soft on terrorism, as the U.S. media talks about it. And the classic example of that is, of course, Al Jazeera. And Al Jazeera is the media conglomerate that is used as kind of the mouthpiece of Al-Qaeda. And, in fact, what we've been seeing is more information this week that emphasizes how Al Jazeera, as the mouthpiece of Al-Qaeda, is really run by the same Western media conglomerates that we know and love and are considered to be on the opposite side of the fence.
Well, isn't that the way they always work it? You have your conservative commentators and your liberal commentators, and here we have the American media on one side and the Arab media or the terrorist media on the other, both controlled by the same people.
Exactly, and they are both controlled by the same people. It follows the same pattern. These strategies work over and over and over again. And as we watch the news day by day and you pull together the right news stories at the right times, these patterns just pop right out.
And, of course, really, it's just so amazing because it's Al-Zawahiri who's always giving us the latest letter from Al-Zawahiri or from Osama bin Laden. And if you read these things through very carefully, you figure that they were probably not written in a cave in Pakistan. They were written in Langley, Virginia, by somebody there in the CIA. And then, of course, presented to Al-Zawahiri to give us the impression it's coming from the wicked Osama bin Laden.
That's right. And as we were seeing, there's been several news reports today that have been talking about how Al Jazeera is basically the same operation as say the BBC or even CNN to a large extent. They're running on the same satellites. They have the same people running the cameras in the back rooms. The people who operate the corporations themselves are long time media people from those major corporations like ABC or the BBC and others.
Now, where's the money coming from? Does anybody ever ask that? I mean, it takes a lot of money to put up an Arab terrorist television network. Where's the money coming from?
That's right. Well, actually, it's coming from several sources. The original statement was that there were a couple of Saudi princes who upfronted the initial cost to Al Jazeera to allow them to spin off from the BBC in the first place. And then over time, though, however, Al Jazeera has actually kind of become a representative of the Muslim world, and they are actually getting a tremendous amount of advertising revenue throughout the Muslim world because of that. They pretty much dominate television in the Middle East, and the advertising revenues that come from that are quite large.
Well, because the thing is that this was funded by the Saudis. Is that why President Bush, when the original 911 Commission report came out, that was the Joint Intelligence Committee, censored that and took out any mention that Saudis had funded the 911 attack, and then insisted on censoring the 911 Commission report and removing anything that would be embarrassing and point to the fact that the Saudis were funding terrorism, not only in the Middle East, but throughout the world, in Africa. The Saudis are funding this whole thing. They're funding the whole Islamic movement in America that's going into our prisons, recruiting people into this radical form of Islam. Why are we allowing that to happen in our prisons? Why are we covering for the Saudis who are funding the terrorist movement throughout the world if we're really funding, we're really fighting terrorists? It doesn't make any sense, does it?
It certainly doesn't. You know, we kind of see that in the perspective of our whole conversation today where, you know, on one side, the government won't allow nativity scenes to exist, you know, out on the street in front of the courthouse, and yet on the other hand, they, you know, behind the courthouse, back in the jails, they seem to be allowing radical fundamentalist Muslim movements to flourish.
Right.
You know, talk about separation of church and state arguments. I think that's terribly hypocritical, and it seems to go further to indicate that there is simply a tolerance for the undermining of America that has gone so broad and so deep that we have to come to the conclusion that there must be a deliberateness to it and an agenda to it.
Okay, pick up the story from there.
Another story is one that comes from the Associated Press saying that a man once considered to be a top Al-Qaeda operative escaped along with three other important prisoners from a U.S.-run detention facility in Afghanistan. And so somehow these three or four top Al-Qaeda terrorists got away from a detention facility there. The interesting thing is these happened to be a rather convenient escape because these were people who were listed to testify about the abuses and torture problems in Afghanistan, and they were supposed to be kind of the prime testimony for the prosecution against the U.S. torture scenarios there in Afghanistan, and they somehow just got out of prison and they're gone. Seems a little bit convenient.
Well, we find a lot of these very, very strange things happening all the time. And isn't it interesting? We've captured all of these major Al-Qaeda terrorists throughout the world, but we don't bring them any of the United States to stand trial. Could it be that some of these people were actually U.S. agents? Could it be that some of these people were trained right here in the United States, like Caleb Sheikh Mohammed? I think he actually was the mastermind of the 9/11 attack, and yet he had attended university here in the United States. lots of strange things go on, but we never want to point that out. We never want to point out, you know, that two of the hijackers were living with an FBI informant in Los Angeles, and our intelligence agencies couldn't find them, but their names were in the telephone book? Come on now, do you really believe that?
That's right, and so there's so many gaps here in the discussion about, you know, who are these terrorists and where they come from, and what they talk about terrorism and terrorists, you know, being arrested all the time, and that, you know, we're fighting this war and we're winning it on this and this front, and here are all the examples of this, or here's the things that we missed, and here's why we missed them, and here's why we need more power to, and more money to build up our fight. On the other hand, and yet, it all seems to fall apart when you put it all together on the same page,
Let me add it all up. One of the things that really, I think every American should be able to see that we're being lied to. The CIA says that we had all this money, but, you know, we just couldn't get anybody into the inner core of Al-Qaeda. I mean, because they're such a close-knit group, and we just couldn't get any people, our people, in there. And yet Johnny Lynn Walker, the boy from Santa Rosa, was able to go over to Afghanistan and join Al-Qaeda and visit with Osama bin Laden several times, but the CIA, with all of its clever agents, wasn't able to figure out where he was or get anybody in to have conferences with him. What's wrong with this story? Why is Johnny Lynn Walker so much smarter than all of our CIA agents put together? Or is it maybe that they're not telling us the truth?
So there's a great, you know, I agree, there's this tremendous amount of disinformation when it comes to the war on terror. In fact, you don't even know what to expect and what to, you know, how to even judge what's real or not real. There was an interesting story that's out there today that talks about what happens if you collect all of the different stories about the successes of our anti-terrorism activities, and you put them all together in one place, and pick out one name such as al-Zarqawi. And Zarqawi is an interesting thing because we seem to hear his name all the time, and everyone's familiar with him as kind of being the leader of the insurgency activity in Iraq right now. And of course, al-Zarqawi is, you know, touted as kind of the primary reason why the U.S. has to stay there for so long, and yet they're constantly coming out with stories that you know, they're really winning the war against al-Zarqawi. And so if you pick up these stories and you put them all together on the same page and look at all the lieutenants, the deputies, the aides, the associates, the second in commands, etc., to al-Zarqawi that have been captured recently, you see that this list is so huge it becomes absolutely ridiculous. It's actually rather funny to see that there are apparently hundreds of top aides to al-Zarqawi that have been captured, and you got to wonder, this doesn't make sense. What are we doing? Are we arbitrarily declaring that every 100th person that we arrest in Iraq is one of al-Zarqawi's top persons?
And you know, the great tragedy is that they don't have water a lot of the time in Baghdad. They don't have electricity, and you know how intolerably hot it would be over there, but there's no electricity for air conditioning, for refrigeration. Is it any wonder that these people wonder whether they're better off now that they've been liberated or where they were before, or at least when they had a stable society? They are killing all sorts of Iraqis, you're on the verge of a civil war over there. It's not safe to drive down the street. People live in constant terror. I mean, dozens and dozens of Iraqis are killed every single day, and this did not exist before we went in there to liberate the Iraqi people from Saddam Hussein, who the American government had kept in power. And if you read Robert Baer's book, See No Evil, he talks about how every Iraqi he met when he was there in 1995 believed the U.S. government was keeping Saddam Hussein in power. Could that possibly be true? And then, after we kept him in power, when the scripts called for it, we went in and took him out, and then we dissolved the Iraqi army, and we dissolved the Iraqi police force, and we dissolved the Iraqi civil service, and you know what happened? We had chaos over there. And now we're just going to have to stay there for 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, to restore law and order, because if we pulled out, there'd be chaos.
That's what they're saying. And yet there's this constant level of disinformation that is being presented to the American public. And it's coming from so many fronts that, that, you know, this week in the World Affairs Brief, you know, we can only seem to grab a handful of propaganda pieces to illustrate, you know, whether it's all the phony media reports of links to Zarqawi, or whether it's the efforts that Australia is doing to build their own version of the Patriot Act, and how they're tweaking the wordage a little bit to expand the powers, all the way to how we're finding out that there are more secret foreign CIA prisons.
Where they're torturing members of Al-Qaeda. Well, it makes you feel good, warm, and fuzzy when we know that the president says that we would never allow torture, and yet he's authorizing torture. Why would he say one thing and do another? And if he would lie to us about the torture, what else would they lie to us about? Would they lie to us about what really happened on the morning of September 11th? Whether they knew ahead of time that there was going to be an attack? And why did they say that they thought the attack was going to be overseas, when they'd already said the president, the daily briefing, August 6th, saying bin Laden determined to attack in the United States? Could it be that everything is a lie? Well, Dr. Stan, our guest is Derek Skousen. Derek, let's get your telephone number and your website out.
Sure. What we've been talking about here are the issues that are part of our analysis from the World Affairs Brief. And you can find out about the World Affairs Brief by going to our website at worldaffairsbrief.com. Again, that's www.worldaffairsbrief.com. And if you want to get a sample of this brief that has been analyzing these issues that we've discussed tonight, you can call toll-free. That's toll-free 877-518-5888. Again, that's 877-518-5888. And we'll mail you a sample copy of the regular email edition of the World Affairs Brief.
All right, very good. Well, we've got about 2 minutes for you to wrap up the program.
So what we've been seeing is this long-term disinformation campaign that is justifying the war on Iraq, and yet at the same time is creating more international antagonism against the United States. We are seeing that the real story in the Iraq Sunni vote against was that the Bush administration has been talking about how they have stepped up and protected that vote by the powers of the military there, when in fact the insurgents deliberately decided to go out and get out the vote instead of getting out the bombs, and in order to try and take it down. We also saw that the process of Karen Hughes, a spokesman for the Bush, to go out and talk to the Muslim world has been a complete PR disaster, and that the Muslim world is completely turned off by Karen Hughes, and even more turned off by the Bush administration as a representative.
And, of course, basically Karen Hughes' job was to try to rally the Muslim support behind American government and make them realize that we weren't against them at all. And what you're saying is that why the Muslims really are not believing her, that when she says, we really love you, we all want to get together, it's just those bad people over there in Iraq, and yet the Muslims really feel that America really is out to destroy the Muslim faith. Is that, would that be a fair statement?
Well, you know, they put somebody, I don't know why they chose Karen Hughes, but it's almost like they chose her to mess the whole thing up. She went down there and did several diplomatic blunders that caused everyone to come to the distinct conclusion that the Bush administration had no clue at all about what the Muslim world was about.
Well, do you think maybe it's possible that they're trying to inflame the anger of the Muslim world against America in preparation for World War III? We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Derek, we're just about out of time. One more time, would you give out your website and your telephone number?
Sure, Dr. Stan. The website where you can see our analysis of the news is at www.worldaffairsbrief.com, or you can get a sample by calling toll-free 877-518-5888.
All right, God bless you. Thank you so very much for being with us, Derek. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And, of course, it is my contention, I really believe that it's accurate, that we are doing everything we can to inflame the Muslim world against the United States. And I believe that they're doing everything they can to turn one group against another here in America. They're bringing in massive numbers of illegal aliens that they can use as a cadre to attack the blacks and to attack the whites and to create the unrest in this country that we see, all throughout the rest of the world. And basically, they love to be able to turn one group against another. This is what they're doing in Europe, is they're turning the Muslim emigres against the society there, and that's why Paris is burning and has been for the last six nights. These are techniques that have been used over and over again to destabilize the society, and of course out of the chaos that comes the loss of freedom. So this is the point that we'd really like to make, is that everything the current administration is doing is to inflame the Muslim world, and I fear in preparation for the coming world war, because behind everything that's going on, there is a master plan. If you go to our website at www.radioliberty.com, you can read there about the truly spiritual battle that is taking place here in America and throughout the world today. I do want to comment that, I believe that our Catholic brethren, those who believe in the divinity of Jesus Christ, are wonderful, wonderful people. I am concerned and a little puzzled why we're going to have the current nominee for the Supreme Court. Gets there, we will have five Catholics on the Supreme Court. I hope that they will adhere to our Constitution rather than following the dictates of someone else. I certainly hope that they will adhere to the pro-life position and the pro-moral position. But the important thing is that whatever a man's religion is, once he accepts the position on the Supreme Court, his job is to interpret the United States Constitution and not, of course, to follow the dictates from anyone else within their church or without the church. And, of course, this is the time when I really need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. We hope many of you will want to join the Radio Liberty family and help us. Our number is 1-800-544-8927. And then I certainly would want to point out that we are having an all-day seminar on the 19th of November. That's a week from Saturday here in the Monterey Bay area, and we do hope that many of you can come. That's the 19th of November. We're serving lunch, so we need to know how many people are going to come. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. Please go to our website at radioliberty.com. If you'd like to get a free copy of our newsletter on the occult hierarchy that rules the world, or on the peak oil, the oil scam that is going, of course, to impoverish so many of the American people, call us and just ask for a free copy of either one of those two newsletters, and then please pray for America. Pray for revival, pray for our leaders and our ministers, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so, until we're together again, may the Lord be with you.